You're listening to the Berkshire Hathaway Annual Shareholders Meeting Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Yahoo Finance.
And we factor in, like I say, we factor in some things that are not ridiculously unlikely. And I'm not going to spell out scenarios because to some extent, if you start spelling out scenarios, you may increase the chance of them happening. So it's not something that we really want to talk about a lot. But our position will be to stay at Fort Knox. But we don't need a 100. It's a little higher now than it was at quarter end. We don't need 130 or 35 billion. But we need a lot of money. That's always available. And that means we own nothing but treasury bills. I mean, we never buy commercial paper. We don't count on bank lines. One or two of our subsidiaries, a few of our subsidiaries have them, but we basically want to be in a position to get through anything. And we hope that doesn't happen, but you can't rule out the possibility any more than in 1929, you could rule out the possibility that you would be waiting until 1955 or the end of 1954 to get even. Anything can happen, and we want to be prepared for anything. But we also want to do big things. If the prices are attractive, as Greg said, there was a period right before the Fed acted. We were starting to get calls. They weren't attractive calls, but we were getting calls, and the companies we were getting calls from after the Fed acted, a number of them were able to get money in the public market, frankly, at terms that we wouldn't have given it to them.
All right. This next question is one that, Greg, you actually touched on the answer to this to some extent, but maybe the two of you could expand on it. It comes from Richard Surser from Tucson, Arizona. He says, Berkshire's annual report indicated that Berkshire had 391,539 employees at the end of 2019. Which areas of our operations have already been hardest hit or will be by the coronavirus pandemic? And what are the implications for the continued employment of those people?
Those people are employed in dozens and dozens of different industries, and there are a few industries that there's a fair likelihood that our employment could be reduced, but they're not large. I'm just thinking as I'm talking. I mean, it's not like we're some of the businesses that are, we're not in the hotel business or various aspects of travel and entertainment and all of that that could really be changed in a very major way. So I don't see our employment. I'll put it this way. 5 years from now, I think Berkshire will be employing considerably more people. And I don't see where we'll have large dips, but the virus could take off in certain ways that in some of our manufacturing businesses, for example, the demand could be dramatically reduced. And in those cases, we would have layoffs at some point. Greg?
What I would add, Warren, is that as we are in the sort of crux of the pandemic, we're still dealing with it, so our businesses have adjusted. Some have had to adjust more. We have, if you look at Berkshire Hathaway Energy, for example, you can see U.S. electricity consumption's down 4%. That realistically doesn't impact that business in a significant way, and longer term, we'll continue to grow that business. So even during the crisis, a relatively small impact to the business. But as Warren knows, we do have retailers that their doors are shut right now, be it our See's Candy, some of our jewelers. And at that point in time, we do adjust and adapt to the environment, i.e. we adjust our workforce. But equally, we do see for example, sees at a point our stores will reopen. And at that point, we reemploy the folks. And overall, for Berkshire as a whole, as Warren said, 5 years from now, we see our employment numbers being far, far, far greater than they are today, in that we see great prospects within the operating businesses as a whole.
Yeah, C's is an interesting example because we've owned that since 1972. That's a long time. And we love it. And we continue to love it. And I have a box here of our peanut brittle, and I've got another box of fudge right here, and I'll probably take them all home and not share with Greg. But we were in the midst of our Easter season, and Easter is a big sales period for C's, and I don't know whether we were halfway through, but we weren't halfway through in terms of the volume that's going to be delivered because it comes toward the end. And essentially, we were shut down, and we remain shut down. The malls that we've got 220 or so retail stores, and we've got a lot of Furniture Mart sells our candy, but the Furniture Mart's closed down. And so C's business stopped. And it's a very seasonal business to start with. So we have a lot of seasonal workers, too, that come in, particularly for the Christmas season. But we have a lot of Easter candy. I mean, Easter candy's kind of specialized, too. So we won't sell it. And we produced a good bit of it, and we couldn't ship it, and we couldn't put it in stores, and there's some of that's going on, and of course Greg does all the work on those sort of situations, and our managers are terrific, of course, in dealing with it, but this is a very, very unusual period, and like I say, a few years from now, I think Berkshire will be employing more people than 395,000. Over the years, we started with 2,000 at the textile business, and we've still got the same playbook.
This next question comes from Drew Johnson, who says that he's a longtime shareholder who's attended a couple of meetings. He says, in an interview on April 17th, Charlie mentioned that some small businesses owned by Berkshire would not reopen after the pandemic eases. Can you elaborate on which businesses might be impacted?
Well, even we have businesses within businesses. At Marmon, don't we have 97 different businesses, for example?
Exactly, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, and there are some that weren't doing that well before. I'm not talking about Marmon specifically, but they got a couple of them, and there's a couple of... And it may be that in effect, you know, what's happened in the last couple of months has accelerated the decline of those businesses, or their customers are developing different habits. I mean, people are developing different habits in retail. There's no question about that. Now, that doesn't mean we haven't got a bunch of good retail businesses, but there are businesses that were having problems before and that have even greater problems. Now, we don't own our newspapers anymore, but we're financing Lee Enterprise, which does have them. We've actually increased our investment in the newspaper business by selling the papers to Lee and then refinancing their debt. And the newspaper business was having plenty of problems with both circulation and advertising before the virus came along, but advertising declines every place have accelerated fairly dramatically. And you know, when the automobile industry stops, the auto dealers don't advertise as much. It's made certain businesses that were tough before even tougher now. And there will be, and the management of at least one of the subsidiaries has suggested to us, and so there'll be some changes at a few businesses, but they're very small businesses. Our major businesses, and our business of intermediate size, I can't think of anything that's of significance that won't reopen. But it won't be any fun with the businesses where the world has really changed. You're seeing a lot of change If you own a shopping center, you've got a bunch of tenants that don't want to pay you right now. We don't. And the supply and demand for retail space may change fairly significantly. The supply and demand for office space may change significantly. A lot of people have learned that they can work at home, or that there's other methods of conducting their business than they might have thought that from what they were doing a couple of years ago. And when change happens in the world, you adjust to it.
Yeah, I think the go ahead,
Becky. I think Greg won. Yeah.
I was just going to add ahead, on the Marmon example. Our 97 companies there. For example, we have a food service group which sells equipment to a variety of the restaurants. We have a few businesses that realistically were challenged when the industry was performing really well, and as we come out of the crisis, their economic prospects aren't going to be better. And in fairness to the teams and the employees in there, they understand that and they're working through it. And there'll be other opportunities potentially within the company, within Marmon and things like that. But, there's a very specific answer or example relative to the question.
This next question is a follow-up on that. It comes from Chris Freed of Philadelphia. And he says, it's been a long-term policy of Berkshire to not sell or close any ongoing subsidiaries as long as their business prospects weren't a money hole. Over the last year, he points out the sale of Berkshire Hathaway Media and then Charlie's comments from that interview saying that several small Berkshire subsidiaries will not be opening when the coronavirus lockdown is lifted. So should shareholders assume that Berkshire has now changed its long-term policy in regards to keeping underperforming subsidiaries around?
I think that policy was spelled out for maybe 30 years or so in the annual report, that we have said that if a company or if an operation, we think its prospects are that it will continually lose money in the future, that we will certainly we'll try to sell it to somebody else. But one way or another, we will not continue to hold it. And that is not a new policy, and it's not been changed. You can say, in effect, we did that with the airline industry to some extent. If we owned all of an airline now, it would be a tough decision to decide whether to sustain billions of dollars in operating losses when you don't know how long it's going to happen or occur. And secondly, that it's very likely that there'll be too many planes around. And we know what happens in airline pricing when load factors go down and there's an oversupply of airline seats. So, we didn't have to make that decision in terms of our own operation on it, but we did make a decision that's a very tough management decision to make. And the government, of course, they've had the first wave of financing for the airlines, but to the airlines' credit, they have very aggressively raised money. I mean, it's amazing to me what a good job they've done of that. And in the case of, two of them, but there may be more coming, they've raised equity money too. I mean, they are saying to the debt holders and investors, you've got to put more money into this business if we're going to be able to continue. And the government's done it, and private sources have done it, and it's going to, it's exactly the right thing for the managements to be doing. But whether it makes sense, we'll find out for the investors.
This next question comes from Eric LaFont, and it's directed to Greg. He asks, how is Precision Castparts handling the severe slowdown in the aerospace industry?
So very consistent with everything we've just discussed, which is obviously a large part of their business is the aerospace industry. And it can really be broken into three areas as we do in our queue, but two are being impacted. The defense contract business remains very sound and strong within precision cast parts. But if you look at the large body aircraft, the aircraft that they use within the regional jets, that business will move directly with the demand there and the jets that are ordered longer term. So precision cast parts is literally, as we speak, continuing to adjust their business relative to the demand that would come out of Boeing. They would be having weekly calls with Boeing, recognizing what are the production orders there and adjusting the business accordingly.
Yeah, Boeing raised $25 billion just a day or two ago, and they raised $14 billion before that. And a year ago, they felt they were in a fine cash position, and I understand how all that happened. Airbus has had the same situation. They've made some comments recently within the last week, you know, the fact that, you know, they really don't know what their future is. And I don't know what their future is. We're going to have aircraft in this country. We're going to be flying. But the real question is whether you need a lot of new planes or not, and when you're likely to need them, and it affects a lot of people, and it certainly affects precision cast parts. It affects General Electric. It obviously affects Boeing, and it is a blow to essentially have your demand dry up, and it goes up in the chain, The aircraft manufacturers didn't bring it on themselves. The airlines didn't bring it on themselves. Precision cast parts didn't bring it on itself. General Electric didn't. It's basically that we shut off air travel in this country. And what that does to people's habits, how they behave in the future, it's just hard to evaluate. I don't know the answer. But we do know that it will have an effect on precision cast parts. And it how severe it will be, it depends on the same sort of variables that are hitting Boeing and you name the company in aircrafts. And aircraft's a big business. And this country's good at it, incidentally, too. I mean, if you think about Boeing, you know, it is what a hell of a company, and it's important. It's a huge exporter, and it affects a lot of jobs. And some of them are with us, and you know, we hope for the best, and we wish everybody the best, obviously, and we wish ourselves the best in it. But part of it is certainly out of our control.
Right. This next question is for Warren. Do you think GEICO will experience unusually high profitability in 2020 due to the reduced amount of driving, even after giving customers a 15% credit?
Well, we have promised to give our customers, at GEICO, we're the second largest auto insurance company, and different auto insurers are handling a sharing of the better experience with their policyholders in different ways. Our plan will deliver back $2.5 billion roughly or so in recognizing the reduced frequency of accidents during this period. What we don't know is how long this will continue. I mean, people want to drive their cars still, but conditions have reduced that driving dramatically, obviously. Now, we have instituted a program that runs saving people money for 6 months, and so far, other people have largely been 2 months, but some of them have given a little more for those 2 months than we give per month. Our total is the greatest at $2.5 billion. And in addition to that, we and all the others in the industry, it's not just GEICO, we've also, and insurance commissioners in many cases, I believe, have required it, but we have, we give people more time to pay if they aren't paying, and if they cancel their policy or if they don't end up paying us, we've in effect giving them free insurance during that period. And And the delay in payments is obviously increased. Delay of payments on, if you got a shopping center getting rent, the delay in payments is what happens during a period like this. And that will be a significant cost to us. We don't know how significant it will be. There will be more uninsured motorists driving, and they cause a disproportionate amount of accidents. And that, so there's a lot of variables. We made our best guess as to what we're going to do to reflect the current reduced accidents in our in our premiums that we receive, really over the next year. It applies for a 6 month on renewals, but that we'll be renewing policies in October that will extend it then next April. And so we've made a guess on it, and we'll see how it works out.
This next question comes from Steven Stoller. He's a shareholder in Atlanta, Georgia, and he says, would you please help us understand the effects of COVID-19 on our insurance businesses? Other insurance companies have reported losses from boosting reserves for future insurance claims that they expect to be paying as a result of coronavirus. Yet in Berkshire's 10-Q released this morning, we do not appear to have reported much of these future expected losses. Can you tell us why this is the case? What kind of risks Berkshire is underwriting that allows us not to be affected by the pandemic? Or conversely, what we are writing that might be?
Well, the amount of litigation that is going to be generated out of what's already happened, let alone what may happen, is going to be huge. Now, just the cost of defending litigation is a huge, enormous expense, depending on how much there is. Now, in the auto insurance field, which is our number one field in terms of premium volume by some margin, that's more definable. But who knows what comes out of it in terms of litigation. But in what they call commercial multiple peril, which involves property losses, and where some people elect to buy business interruption coverage, many policies quite clearly in the contract language would not have a claim for business interruption under a commercial multiple peril policy where you've elected that. But other policies do. I think I know of one company, I don't know the details, that's written a fair amount where they cover, or they, certainly there's a good argument perhaps that they cover business interruption that might arise from a pandemic. Well, they're in a very different position than the standard language, which says that you recover for business interruption only if there's involves physical damage to the property. And you can buy all kinds of different policies. We are not big in the commercial multiple peril business. So, I mean, this is not like our auto business or anything of the sort. But we will have claims, we'll have litigation costs, but proportionally, it's not the same with us as with some other companies, which have been much heavier in writing business interruption as part of a commercial multiple peril. But you don't automatically get coverage if you have business interruption. I mean, for example, I think it would be unusual if, say, General Motors had a strike, which they did, and that they have business interruption that covers the strike. Now, we actually wrote about, probably the only annual report in the United States, we wrote about business interruption insurance because we had it over in France when one of our properties was adjacent to a property that's much smaller property that had a fire, and then it spread to our plant, and it caused a lot of physical damage, and we have business interruption that ties in with that. But if we had some company we were selling auto parts to and they had a strike, our business would be interrupted, but it's not covered by the, I mean, that is not part of the coverage unless you specifically really buy it. So there's there's some claims that are going to be very valid related to this, the present situation. There'll be an awful lot that there'll be litigation on that won't be valid, and there's no question that some insurance companies, I know one in particular, that will pay a lot of money relative to their size in terms of policies that they've written. And I think we have reserved, and our history shows we generally have reserved on the conservative side adequately, at least. And that's certainly our intent. And we tell no managers of any of our insurance operations what numbers we expect from them or do any of that, that they evaluate their losses and they build in something for social inflation. They build in things for all kinds of things. And generally speaking, Berkshire's been pretty accurate in its reserving. And I have no reason to think that we're otherwise than that currently.
Stephen Tedder from Atlanta, who says he's a 10-year Berkshire shareholder, writes in and he says, do you see Berkshire offering pandemic coverage in future insurance policies?
Well, the answer is we insure a lot of things. Sure. We had somebody come to us the other day wanting insurance involving a $10 billion protection on something very unusual. We're not going to make that deal in all probability. In fact, I would say it's dead. But we would have written pandemic insurance if people had come to us and offered us what we thought was the right price. We would have been wrong probably in doing it. But we have no reluctance to quote on very unusual things and very big limits. We're famous for it. We haven't done that much of it in certain periods because the prices aren't right. But if you want to come and insure almost anything, and we don't want you to insure against fire if you happen to be a known arsonist or something, but if you come to us with any unusual coverages, either in size or in the nature of what's covered, Berkshire is a very good place to stop. So somebody wants to buy, they can dream up the coverage and they can tell us the price they'll pay, we'll consider writing it. We wrote a lot of business after 9/11, for example, and there were really only a couple companies in the world that were willing to write the business. And Berkshire and AIG wrote a lot of business, and we thought we knew what we were doing, but we could have been surprised. I mean, there could have been some follow-on incidents from 9/11 that we wouldn't have known about. And, you don't know for sure the answer. That's why people are buying insurance. But we would be willing to write pandemic coverage at the right price.
This next question is for Greg, and it comes from a shareholder named Todd Flaska. He says, I don't expect Berkshire to outperform the S&P 500 during good times. However, I remain a long-term investor because of the huge war chest that can be deployed during the downturns in the market like we're seeing right now. Warren has been brilliant at negotiating mutually favorable deals with companies that have somewhat urgent capital needs during these downtimes. These opportunities may only come about once a decade. There's a small window of time for these deals. They all come at once, and you don't really know if you're at the bottom of the market when the deals start coming. Will Berkshire be able to continue this approach when Warren and Charlie are no longer at the helm?
I fundamentally, without Warren and Charlie at the helm, I don't see the culture of Berkshire changing. I don't see our billet, which a large part of that is having the business acumen to understand the transaction, the economic prospects, and then the ability to act quickly. I really don't see that changing as we evolve. Listen, you know, there's no one better than Warren and Charlie, but equally, we've got a talented team in Berkshire, both at the Berkshire level and within our managers that can obviously look at opportunities too very quickly. But, you know, the reality is it's a huge advantage we have right now, when we would clearly want to be in a position to maintain that position of strength. Warren?
Yeah, we will maintain it. And we not only have it with the managers of the, in some cases, not all cases by a long shot, but in some cases we have managers that will occasionally come up with something that can be quite attractive. But between Greg and Todd.
Thanks for listening to this section of the Berkshire Hathaway's annual Shareholders Meeting podcast. The next section can be found in the next episode in your podcast feed. Please go check it out. If you enjoy this podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.